Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. What happens when people take to the streets to march under the banner of science? How do you sort out the truth from the misconceptions and lies? Is science in danger? And if so, from whom? And while we're at it, what is science? And does it belong to everyone? Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation came together to answer these questions in an event called March for Science or March for Scientism, Understanding the Real Threats to Science in America. The panel discussion included Stephen Meyer, Wesley J. Smith, Jay Richards, and Marlo Lewis. On a handful of episodes, we bring you highlights of the event in bite-sized segments. Today, Director of Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism and author of The War on Humans, Wesley J. Smith, discusses what he sees as the real threats to science in America. Listen in.
You know, I find this whole March for Science rather odd. First, I don't know of anybody who's anti-science, maybe Ted Kaczynski, but other than that, science is a method. It is a very powerful method by which human beings gain knowledge of the world and find applications to hopefully improve the human condition. It can, of course, go the other way. But science is a method. It's an amoral method. It's a very powerful method. And yet we are told by certain members of the media within the science intelligentsia that there are those among us who are anti-science, so much so that we need a march. Which seems to me to be an obvious attempt to harness the energy of the March for Women that occurred right after the inauguration, only without the funny pink hats. The people who I think are actually harming science, and I think harming people who do the bench science, because bench scientists aren't part of this. Bench scientists are sitting in their work, their labs, their field work, and they're trying to gain the information in an apolitical way. But the people who are pushing the March for Science and the media in particular, their actions are the ones, I think, that if anyone's hurting science, it's them. And there are four ways that I can think of, and I only have, since I've been not given my usual hour and a half, there are four ways I think this is happening, but I'll only discuss two of them. The first one is that often science is conflated with ethics or morality. So if somebody takes a different ethical position than the, quote, science advocate, then the person with the different ethical position is labeled anti-science. Second, anti-science is used as an epithet to shut down legitimate debate. Third, and this was mentioned in the previous discussion, the consensus is now used to stifle exploration of legitimate heterodox hypotheses. And I think Steve knows about that really, really well. And the fourth is there are some statements being made that are truly, if the term can be used, anti-science, that the mainstream or the liberal intelligentsia or the science intelligentsia often ignore. And I will get into that. So let me talk a little bit about the conflation of science with ethics and morality. I saw this most acutely and first when I was involved in the embryonic stem cell debate during the George Bush years. And I was making an ethical claim to support George W. Bush's funding policy for embryonic stem cell research. And often you would hear things like, well, Bush has banned embryonic stem cell research. He hadn't. In fact, the Bush administration spent tens of millions of dollars with NIH funding of human embryonic stem cell research, which often was not reported. But I would be in front of legislatures, and I would hear scientists, I mean, PhD scientists who did work, actually lie to legislators or to the media and say things that were patently false. And one of them was that an embryo is not really human life. I had done my research with embryology textbooks, which is science. An embryology textbook after embryology textbook told me that a human embryo is a nascent human being, that is a developing human being, and that means it is human life. Now, science can tell us what that embryo is. It cannot tell us whether it is right or wrong to use that embryo instrumentally in research. That isn't in the realm of science. Science can only tell us what the embryo is biologically. It cannot tell us whether it is wrong to destroy that embryo for stem cells. That is a different realm of discussion. But I would hear that because I was making an ethical claim with which many who wanted to do this research disagreed, that I was somehow against science itself. And yet, once in a while, some clarity goes through the clouds of obfuscation. There's a book by Lee M. Silver. Lee M. Silver is a biology professor at Princeton, and he wrote a book that's very helpful to my positions. He didn't mean it that way, but it is, called Remaking Eden. And in the book Remaking Eden, which is actually an early transhumanist manifesto about how we are all going to someday become, he wouldn't call them spirit beings because he's a materialist, but immaterial beings that will make the current human beings look the equivalent of earthworms. That's we'll be off in the sky somewhere understanding everything there is to exist in the material world. But during that book, he talks about the fact, from his perspective, that the term embryo has been redefined for a political purpose. And let me quote Lee M. Silver. I'll let you in on a secret. The term pre-embryo, which is often used for a pre-implantation embryo, has been embraced wholeheartedly for reasons that are political and not scientific. The new term is used to provide the illusion that there is something profoundly different between what we non-medical biologists still call a six-day-old embryo, the blastocyst, and what we and everyone else call a 16-day-old embryo, an embryo that has begun to develop differentiated tissues. Now, I have heard scientists say, that's not an embryo, it's a blastocyst. Before legislative committees, trying to claim that a blastocyst wasn't an embryo. And as Silver just pointed out, a blastocyst is an embryo, and that is how it is the term used for a particular stage of embryonic development. The term pre-embryo is useful in the political arena where decisions are made about whether to allow early embryo, now called pre-embryo experimentation, as well as in the confines of a doctor's office where it can be used to allay moral concerns that might be expressed by IVF patients. Don't worry, a doctor might say, it's only pre-embryos that we're manipulating and freezing. They won't turn into real human embryos until we put them back in your body. And that's close quote. Now, that to me is anti-science. When you take a basic term, a basic biological term, embryo or blastocyst, and redefine it for a political purpose, causing division within the society, you have actually harmed the scientific enterprise because you are going to take the idea of bench scientists and the scientific science as a method, and you are going to make it so political that some people are going to turn away from science itself as a positive good. And that was just false. In another example, I was called anti-science because I opposed three-parent human embryos. Well, I wasn't making a science claim, I was making an ethical claim. There's no way that can be called anti-science. In fact, I am very pro-science, as is everyone on this dais. Here's another example. At the presentation of the American Association for the Advancement of Science a few years ago, that with all due respect and great fanfare, there was a presentation for Cetacean rights, that is, rights for whales and dolphins. Now, granting rights to whales and dolphins is not a question of science. That's a question of morality. That's a question of philosophy. That's a question of politics. And this is all part of the animal rights movement, which we should distinguish from animal welfare. Those are not the same thing at all. And so some of the presenters concluded that every Cetacean, that is a whale or a dolphin, has a right to life. Now, I'll wager that many of those who made that presentation don't think that humans have a right to life, because it's not science, it's politics. Science can't tell us whether humans have a right to life. Some of the others, all Cetaceans have the right to freedom of movement and residence within their natural environment. This is actually setting forth human duties that are being posited towards whales and dolphins. Dolphins can't have rights. They can't even understand the concept. We can define our duties towards them. We can also define them so extremely, as we often see in these debates, that we're going to do great sacrifice to human well-being. But this was at a science symposium, a convention to promote science. That's not science. That's not science. I will move past the anti-science epithet, which I mentioned briefly, and the use of the consensus to stifle heterodox research and hypotheses, and get into some of the things that are being stated out in the media and by science advocates who claim to be science advocates that are just really bizarre, and they don't even seem to warrant comment from the supposed defenders of science. For example, in the New York Times, which frequently castigates people who challenge the consensus on global warming or challenge the consensus on neo-Darwinism as being anti-science, they published, with all due respect, a professor saying that peas are persons. Yes, peas, you know what we eat, peas. And here's what he said. The renewal, when it comes to a plant, it turns out to be not only a what, but also a who. An agent in its milieu with its own intrinsic value or version of the good. A pea is not sentient. A pea doesn't think. What he was talking about or writing about was that the peas apparently through some chemical action can alert other pea plants that there might be a drought, for example. But it isn't sentient. It isn't a who. That is not an intentional action. It is just what happens because of how the pea exists in today's world. But in the New York Times, and a book was written about it, and this fellow is Michael Martyr, who's a PhD, of course, sorry guys. He basically said we shouldn't eat annuals, but only perennials, because we can justify eating perennials because that's like a gift from us. But the pea doesn't know if we eat the pea. The tomato doesn't know if we eat the tomato. That was published in the New York Times. And here's a publishing from a woman who is the New York Times, or at least was when she wrote this, science writer named Natalie Angier. She said that plants are the most ethical life form. As if plants have ethics. Quote, just because we humans can't hear them doesn't mean plants don't howl. Some of the compounds that plants generate in response to insect mastication, their feedback, you might say, are volatile chemicals that serve as cries for help. Such airborne alarm cells have been shown to attract both large predatory insects like dragonflies, which delight in caterpillar meat, and tiny parasitic insects which can infect a caterpillar and destroy it from within. The plant is not aware that it is releasing those chemicals. Something else, I think Steve would say, something that was very intelligent, made that occur. She goes on, it's a small daily tragedy that we animals must kill to stay alive. Plants are the ethical autotrophs here, the ones that rest their meals from the sun. Don't expect them to boast. They're too busy fighting to survive. They can't boast. They don't know. And what about those Venus fly traps? They digest those flies alive. I mean, this is just crazy. And to me, if anyone should be complaining about anti-science advocates for science, it should be a science writer in the New York Times writing that kind of claptrap. This has also led to some public policy issues. Switzerland's constitution has declared the intrinsic dignity of individual plants. Now, that's not a scientific statement. That's an ideological statement. So the government assigned this big committee, Science and Bioethics Committee, to decide why it is that science should and the law of Switzerland should accord individual plants dignity. And it reminded me of a joke. When I've been in debates with neo-Darwinists and others who have said, you know, there really is no distinction between the species. Since we all evolved out of the same primordial ooze, we should do away with species distinctions. And I'll say, well, let's really get reductionist. Carrots are made from carbon molecules, and so are we, so there's no distinction between us and carrots. That's been my joke. Why do plants have dignity according to this report, which is called The Dignity of Living Beings with Regard to Plants? I will quote you. This opinion was justified either by arguing that plants strive after something, plants are not striving. Striving is a conscious decision, which should not be blocked without good reason, or that recent findings in natural science, such as the many commonalities between plants, animals, and humans at molecular and cellular levels, remove the reasons for excluding plants in principle from the moral community. My joke is now the public policy of Switzerland. That, to me, is anti-science. And by the way, this kind of thing has real impact. The Wall Street Journal had an article that was very disturbing. A fellow was doing, in Switzerland, research on wheat, and he wanted to make it so that the wheat, bless you, so that the wheat would be less subject to fungus. And he was denied the funding until he was able to go and say, but this would be good for the wheat. And so then he got the funding, and then because of this, the true anti-science, the anti-GMO types, he was developing this wheat that would resist fungus, that could help ease so much starvation, and the true anti-science types in the anti-GMO world went in and they tore up all the experimental wheat. And you didn't see headlines in the New York Times about anti-science. You didn't see the marchers in the streets saying, protect the GMO research. In fact, from my understanding of that march, some of the sponsors are anti-GMO organizations. Now, one can be anti-GMO, but that's not science. That's policy, that's ethics, that's morality. And it's also interesting that many of the people who are against GMO are pro-human cloning. So go figure. There's also something coming down the pike now, and it's becoming very alarming to me, called nature rights. That is the nature rights movement to grant rights, human-type rights, to nature. I don't know if you saw in the last couple of weeks, but two rivers have been declared to be persons and given human-type rights, one in New Zealand and two in India, one of them being the Ganges River. And two glaciers have also been declared to be persons, with basically equal rights to humans. And then committees were assigned to decide what should be done with the river. And if the river is deemed to be harmed, the river is going to be able to bring a lawsuit in the same way a human being might if the human being was rear-ended or something. Now, does this mean that the Ganges has the right to flow unimpeded to the sea? And if the Ganges, why not the Colorado? If the Colorado River is a person entitled to rights, do we have to tear down Hoover Dam? And consider what this means in terms of human exceptionalism, the unique value of human beings as well as our duties. If nature has rights, that means pond scum, viruses, mosquitoes, then everything has rights. And if everything has rights, the very concept of rights loses its potency. It'll be like a currency in the Weimar Republic. It'll become meaningless. And I see Jay telling me to shut up. So I will cool it for now, but it seems to me that the real problem here in terms of science becoming a divisive aspect of our culture isn't science. It's certainly not the bench scientists. It's those who are politicizing science to win political debates, to win cultural debates, and to win moral debates. Thank you.
That was Wesley J. Smith on a panel event co-hosted by Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation, discussing the real threats to science in America. For more on these topics, check out our written coverage of the March for Science at The Stream. You'll find it at stream.org/tag/ScienceWeek2017. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.